We're still playing with the with the subtitle. The title is AI Narratives. The subtitle could be From Homer to Hal, I was thinking of, or Stevens from Imagining Intelligent Machines from 2000 BC to 2001 AD. But the point is to try and actually cover that massive breadth. And whilst most discussions of artificial intelligence and in literary studies focus on the 20th century, we have got a whole part one on the prehistory. So we've got someone writing on antiquity, someone writing on the medieval period, the Renaissance, the Victorian, and modernism, so the kind of sector turn of the century. So we're trying to show that whilst most focus is on more contemporary thinking, there's a prehistory to these narratives as well. And the reason we all hesitated is that we don't hold a distinction between genre fiction and literary fiction. We did an interview for the university's Research Horizon magazine, and the question he asked all of us was, you know, what's your guilty pleasure? And he just got blank looks from all of us. We were like, you just can't have a guilty pleasure unless you believe that watching or reading some stuff is not worth doing. Whereas for me, as long as the scholarly apparatus that you're bringing to it and the way you're writing and studying and researching it is of the right level, it doesn't matter what you're working on.
And in literary fiction, especially the very contemporary science fiction, you can start seeing explorations of questions around artificial intelligence that especially big budget Hollywood is nowhere near.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at some of the prize-winning science fiction of the past couple of years, I think my favourite example is Anne Leckie's work, which was a trilogy starting with Ancillary Justice, so the Ancillary Trilogy, and now she just had a new book out set in the same universe, which for a change concerns disembodied artificial intelligence, and then the issue of what happens if that intelligence ends up in one body, and how we see the narrative through the eyes of that artificial intelligence that does not have the capabilities of distinguishing between persons the way in which humans do. So famously, everyone in those novels is referred to as she, regardless of gender, because that AI cannot quickly distinguish between gender other than sort of the long hair or stereotypes that she basically has to feel her way around.
Anne Leckie's work's a really good example because I'm always interested in kind of bi-directional influence. What Leckie's doing is thinking and writing about AI in ways that are useful, I think, and productive and helpful. But also she's realised that it can do really interesting things with fiction. So of course, if you've got a distributed AI who can be embodied in multiple bodies at different sites at the same time, wonderful narrative. You don't need an omniscient narrator. You don't need the kind of, you know, the Jane Austen godlike. You can narrate these different moments from the same consciousness that's seeing and doing different things. So narratively, it's absolutely fascinating. The other one I was thinking about when you were talking, Cantor, was Ted Chiang's The Life Cycle of Software Objects. And he was he's the writer who wrote the story that Arrival is based on, which I think is a good science fiction film, and actually is about alien intelligence. And although it's not about artificial intelligence, I think it's one of the most interesting big budget thinkings of intelligence we've got. That was his short story. But The Life Cycle of Software Objects is also kind of interested in personhood and I think the objects can be incorporated, which is their way of kind of gaining some kind of legal agency.
And also the issue of distributed AI actually reflects a much broader area of actual scientific research into AI, because those robots such as Sophia is such a niche area and has so little to do with actual artificial intelligence research, so that there is a lot of fiction out there that focuses in on one area of the research, whereas artificial intelligence as a field offer so many more narrative options.
You can tell you've got us on our favourite topic. And one last thing before we move on, but if you want really good fiction on code and algorithms, and everyone's bored of me saying this, but read M. John Harrison's Kefahuchi Trap trilogy, Empty Space, Light, and Nova Swing, not in that order. But what's so brilliant about what Johnson is that he's imagining the way in which code is seductive, the way in which it can penetrate us in manifold ways and determine our behaviour and our actions in ways that we might not even be conscious with, and that we might, if those of you who know Deleuze and Guattari, that there can be a kind of becoming code where the human and the non-human are integrated or intersected in interesting and fascinating and disturbing ways. And it really is a tremendous trilogy that deserves to be read and studied more.
Question.
Hi, on a similar sort of note, it was interesting that throughout this discussion of agency and intelligence and consciousness, it's quite often framed in terms of human-machine intelligence, or human-like machines, but issues of consciousness and agency weren't often situated in a wider field of non-human and non-human agency, you know, animal, special, mineral agency. And I was wondering how useful this kind of field, a sort of Donna Haraway type scholarship, might be for thinking through the issue.
Yeah, I it's something I've been really thinking about because I was doing a lot of work in animal studies before I moved into AI, and I feel in some way that all the questions, as Candace taught beautifully illustrated, that are being raised by AI haven't even been resolved in relation to human beings and non-human animals. But this is why I think we find it so fascinating. Stephen had a great joke at our conference last year, which I'll steal from a bit. So, you know, philosophers have been trying to solve the problem of consciousness for centuries. No one told us we had a deadline, which was fantastic. And I think that sums up that fact that... So in a way, I feel sad that we're thinking about these things that haven't even happened yet, before we've even solved the things that are happening. But actually, I think AI is acting as a catalyst or a prompt for trying to resolve that thinking in ways that can then benefit real people, non-human animals. So we do have a project team working on intelligence who are looking at animal intelligence, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. We have a project called Kinds of Intelligence, which is led by Marta Helena, who featured in Beth's film, who's an expert in chimp cognition. And part of our grand ambition is to map the space of possible intelligences drawing for inspiration on comparative psychology as well as machine intelligence. I think this is a particularly interesting moment. I mean, you'll have seen that one of the big themes is what it means to be human and exploring all of these attributes that we've thought of as distinctively human. It's an interesting moment to be doing that, not only because of the challenge to the uniqueness of those qualities from machines, but because that exact same challenge has been coming from our better understanding of animals. And I think that's something we do very much have in mind in our work.
As a sort of data point, I noticed something interesting the other day. I do a lot of my research on social media, so I was constantly scanning conversations, that there is a startup that wants to train crows to pick up rubbish. And then I actually saw an AI researcher be very excited about this, and I thought this showed a slight lack of self-reflexivity on the fact that a lot of AI research is about the problems of value alignments and wireheading, and that an AI given a task could go into overdrive to do that task. So Bostrom's idea of the superintelligence and the paperclip manufacturer, that this happens in the animal kingdom when humans interact and rework their training. And this AI researcher was very enthusiastic about this idea without either consideration of ravens and crows going overboard with this, which we've seen in dolphins clearing up their aquariums, or the fact that this might not be ethical. There's no suggestion. It was just another way of saying this animal could be a machine. So the relationship can go the other way in that paralleling.
When you were talking in the film about the response to the perceived suffering of the robots that are being abused, you do have that instinctive response, but you said we were anthropomorphizing, but of course not all of them are anthropomorphic. A lot of them are actually canine, and actually in the lifecycle of software objects, their avatars are are made to look like little baby animals.
Yeah.
So it's a good question in that there's a lot. I think there's a huge amount of crossover, and that might be something we want to pursue a little bit more actually with people who are working on animal rights and non-human animals.
So we talk a little bit in the second film about hacking empathy. So that some of the models are very childlike, not necessarily the Boston Dynamics ones, which are much more utilitarian working.
But
what
Pepper,
what
I guess.
Pepper
yes.
now, the Chinese, Japanese bots by the side of the lady's bed.
It's always big eyes. My pony, sorry, I've got an 8 and 6 year old girl, massive eyes. That's the kind of thing that attracts us and draws us.
But even when artificial intelligence is not embodied at all, so AlphaGo, which basically just exists on some large black servers, I've got pictures of them. When playing against Lee Sedol, fan art came out representing AlphaGo as humanoids. Quite often, young female Asian playing Go in, as anime manga style art. So even when there is nothing physical for us to latch on and anthropomorphize, the concept, the idea of intelligence playing a game, we fill in the blanks for that and we come up with a persona and a character.
I will also be exploring this issue of kinds of intelligence and kinds of minds in a conference titled Kinds of Minds that we'll be holding in June. The keynotes of one of the keynotes will be given by Peter Godfrey Smith, who recently had a popular book out on the intelligence of the octopus.
Mm-hmm. We all know it's going to be jellyfish that ends us all, anyway. Not AI. There was
Lovecraft,
a horrifying documentary
on
the jellyfish. Yeah, they are incredibly smart and will survive the apocalypse.
They are
very
good.
Sorry, Zoe's got a hand up at the back.
I don't know. It's really fascinating. I'm really interested in this, the question of this distributed AI, because the focus is on, I guess, in relation to, is it because in relation to narrative that there's a focus on humanoids? Is it because are these two have a representation which is like us or a mimicry? How far? Because I said something, is there not a kind of specialization going on in all sorts of arenas, such as what it means to be human, none of which look anything like being human, but all of which in their own specialist areas do something that humans once did a certain way, much more efficiently, such that the territory has changed of what it means to be human without there being a human-like
It's spot on, and it's one of the other strands of the project, which is in collaboration with the Royal Society, and they're very interested to think about diverse AI narratives, not just in the sense of diversity that me and Cantor were talking about, but in the sense of the diverse types of AI that are being represented. I think there's an obvious problem with cinema, which is that you kind of need bodies in cinema. Now, Her gets around that in really interesting and clever ways. And we're beginning to see science fiction cinema that can imagine non-anthropomorphic bodies. And I think Arrival, again, is one of the kind of best examples of that. Literature, I think, is more interesting. And Ian M. Banks, I think, was way ahead of his time with his culture novels. Which have intelligent minds and have robots, and I'm quite clear that there's a distinction between those two things. And it's easier to have a disembodied character in a novel, but you still need a character. So here we've got that interesting clash between what the science is actually doing and what stories need.
It's also a question, I suppose, isn't it? How possible is it to represent non-reflective kind of non-humanoid artificial intelligence that takes certain areas of activity? Because that seems to be sort of, I know even with iPhones, right, that it's changed the way that we think about time, changes the nature of an event like this to something quite special, because for once we're in the same time, in the same place, concentrating more or less on the same thing, although a beep might go and someone might be distracted, our relation to communication technologies, and that's not even taking it to the point. So I just wondered if there's any kind of literature or thinking more generally going on about what I'm so interested in how the sort of data basis starts to organise the directions in which those forms of
especially with the ease versus obsolescence dichotomy that Stephen mentioned, the obsolescence, the emotional obsolescence of humans, has been explored quite well in literature, in stories in which humans have everything taken care of for them. So what is left when a human is catered in every sense of their life? And so E.M. Forster's The Machine Stops then shows how completely dependent people have become on the machine, and then when it does stop, how their lives are destroyed, but also they no longer have any survival instincts other than to turn to that machine that is no longer working, and they grasp onto its last functions as it deteriorates without any attempt to find out what's going wrong or getting out. And Isaac Asimov did something similar in one of his novels set in the Foundation universe. I think it's the same planet comes up in several of his novels, actually. It's called Solaris. And on Solaris, there's quite a big community of humans, but each human lives on its own individual estate, catered for by an army of robots. And humans only interact with each other when that is absolutely necessary, via video chat, and the whole bit about reproduction they don't want to talk about, so we don't get to see how that works. So these novels then really do ask the question of what is humanity when you take out everything that gives us purpose in our lives, and are these people still human?
So are you asking whether people have explored it in literature or whether scholars are also researching it?
Both. I mean,
it's kind of slightly beyond our field of expertise, but there must be work being done in psychology and cognitive science. I think not least because we're already seeing the impact in the kind of the teenagers coming through of social media on mental health in quite terrifying ways.
Yeah. I mean, there are various people trying to, from philosophical and theological positions as well, answer the question, what is a human being for? Which underlies all the kind of above level questions of what is the future of work, what does the future look like when more things are automated, when we have this allegedly excessive free time to do whatever we want, what does that mean for our self-definitions? And from a narrative's perspective, those are answered in various different ways. And also the reflection on what the human is in relation to technology and some hypothetical godhead as well, where that places people. There are lots of different religious responses to that, which is slightly more to do with what the Faraday is looking at than what the CFI is looking at.
But The Machine Stops, the book of the machine is worship, so there's a theological element.
Yeah, I've just finished reading Dan Brown's Origin, which I'm not a huge Dan Brown fan, but if you want a kind of
no guilty pleasure.
Really. I mean, I did read it in
pleasure.
A day because they're so easy to read and they're cliffhanger every chapter, so you're going through really fast. But if you want an outline of a secularist transhumanist version of what the human being is for, he's outlined in a fictional narrative a lot of the main arguments of people like Kevin Kelly and Kurzweil and other singularity thought people in a fairly adventurous way. Robert Langdon again, saving the day. Yeah.
Well, theologians have had to grapple with this question for thousands of years in conjuring ideas of heaven that seem plausible yet attractive. And of course, that's what utopian technologists are also required to do.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to relate that point to the earlier one about relationship to other forms of biological intelligence. It's very interesting to see how it's played out in the history of AI itself, where the kind of tasks we've set for AI in order to demonstrate its intelligence have been very cerebral and this is because we understand intelligence as that which distinguishes ourselves from other forms of life. And so we very much pride ourselves in our intelligence. We think historically we thought it puts us at the top of the tree of life and so forth. It's what makes us different to guinea pigs and horses and so on. And so, you know, that's the pinnacle, that's what we ought to strive for. But it turned out that was easy. It's actually easy to build machines that remember better than we do, that reason better than we do, that beat us at maths and chess and now Go and so forth, whereas doing the things the guinea pig can do are really hard. And what we've learned about ourselves, I think, I mean, is exactly in contrasting ourselves to other animals, we've lost a lot of what makes us special and distinctive and interesting, and now we're contrasting ourselves against machines. We are appreciating much more the hundreds of millions of years that have gone into things like hand-eye coordination and gut instinct.
Yeah.
We're rediscovering our animality.
There's also an interesting angle to that from a feminist perspective, which is lots of the things that used to be valorized as masculine, so reason, strength, all of those kind of qualities are actually the ones that are really easy to reproduce, whereas things like empathy, emotion, common sense, qualities that have traditionally been coded as feminine are actually really difficult. So it looks like, you know, we've got a bright future. But
yes and no, because also women have been pushed into the kind of administrative roles, which also, so there's the, see this in the history of computer science itself, that to begin with, coding was really a female task.
Yeah, yeah.
The earliest computers were female, they were women computing.
Have you seen Hidden Figures? Wonderful film.
Yeah.
That shows that exactly, there's a curious way in which the patriarchy can adapt to assimilate to whatever is currently deemed to be more important or more difficult.
I want to ask about this opposition that seems to be lurking in these traditions between the individual and the system, between fear of networks, ecologies, where there's a decentered authority and an invisible, unmotivated control. To what extent, can you just talk a bit about that, about how your work, because it seems to me that the traditions of narrative have already inscribed themselves in AI just because they are focused on individuals, heroised characters, the idea of you know, the individual in a quest, being challenged, and yet actually what's desperately needed to cope with the realities of social media, the digital era, is a sophisticated, emotional and human understanding of systems and how they scare us.
Well, not necessarily that they scare us, but actually that I've never been a big fan of the kind of realist heroic novel and always been much more interested in novels and films that are more formally experimental in terms of their intertwining of multiple narrative strands. And though, whilst those kind of stories have existed, I think there has been a resurgence of them. I'm always hesitant about saying they never existed until now, but you're starting to see stories like Cloud Atlas, which I mentioned, which has multiple narratives across multiple historical periods. Or an early film, what was it called? Go. Was it called Go? You're too young, probably. Which had the girl from Dawson's Creek in it. Which again is multiple perspectives on different events. And it's there in The Bridge Over Sunday in Ray, and it's there in another David Mitchell's novels, Ghost Written.
Japanese film, Rashomon,
which I haven't seen yet. But I think it's a really, it's that question again of how does thinking about AI actually start to make us think differently about how we construct our narratives. And I don't think the most interesting narratives we construct anymore, at least from my point of view, are the ones that are focused on a kind of single character and their journey from wherever to wherever.
There is a line of argument that says historically we've reached a stage of the triumph of the individual, the triumph of the self, I think it's brief, right? That we've had periods of history where we've been much more communal and social and haven't had such a conception of the individual as actor and agent, but I'm not sure I buy that line of thinking. I think we've always had individuals that have subsumed themselves into communities but also withdrawn from communities at various points as well. So in terms of fiction, that's highlighted at various points and withdrawn and then returns again.
Of course, the thing about fiction that's so wonderful about it is that it's irreducibly equivocal, so it can be both things at the same time. And you see that in something like Naomi Alderman's novel, The Power, which won the Bailey's Prize for Fiction last year. So, and she does a similar thing that Mitchell does, which is you still have focalization through individual characters, but you move. So you still have your story with your one person, but you suddenly realize that story with that one person, that person was actually sitting next to the person from the other story. And then as you read, you start to see that these things are intertwining and that we're all interconnected. And I've written about that in relation to Mitchell during theoretical biology, the difference between, I'm going to get this wrong now, autopoietic and allopoietic systems. So an autopoietic system is something that, like a human being, something that's alive but that feeds back within itself and is self-contained. And an allopoietic system is something that we might say is distributed or dependent upon external things. And I think novels and films can be both. They can have the autopoietic and the allopoietic, and actually one of the beauties of narrative is how it weaves those two different elements together whilst preserving them as separate.
I wonder if the extent to which at the moment, and I defer to Eucrates on this, science fiction or speculative fiction is not really engaging with systemic approaches to the relationship between humans and technology is something of a question of the legacy of a moment about 100 years ago when people were very anxious about technology and various movements like communism and fascism had very powerful fantasies about what technology could be and how it ought to shape society and the machine as a model for society. And these were, of course, highly bureaucratized and rigid societies and very interesting and influential science fiction like We and Brave New World and 1984 were born of that moment where the heroic individual basically escapes the system.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you've ever really sort of had the fiction that goes back to the system.
Yeah, you get it in a lot of feminist science fiction in the 1970s, but the system is reimagined as a kind of usually quite hippie collective. But it is there in that work, Joanna Russ's work and Marge Piercy's. That's really interesting to think about that in relation to more recent SF.
Hi, thanks for this. This is really really very interesting work here. And I was wondering if you could speak some more. You've spoken a bit about gender, but if you speak more about race and artificial intelligence. So Sarah, you came up with a couple of examples, and Stephen, I think your work on intelligence, of course, speaks to this, but I wonder if there is some ways in which, artificial intelligence and its representations are so white, and like what work is kind of that doing? And I think there's a lot going on there. I just wanted to kind of get this news to say some more about how you were thinking about the ways in which race is being produced and reproduced. The real examples are really famous from the course, but is there a deeper story to tell here? I noticed they even used the word servant in Ukraine on slavery, right?
Yeah.
About this. I think there's, invite you to say more.
Can I play my clip?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we can answer.
Nice. Okay, Noel, you try. Too black.
Do you see what I mean about it? Just summing it up.
Hello, everyone. This is your daily dose of internet.
Sorry. Brilliantly and horrifically, the small to large impact that lack of recognition of just simply the fact that people have different coloured skin can have on the lived experiences of people who are engaging with technology. And that's a small example, but you extrapolate that out to huge, bigger things. And one of the things that I'm deeply concerned about is that if things don't change in terms of development of tech, that it's going to just perpetuate and reinforce and make worse the inequalities that we already have. And that's something that has to not happen, which is why I like Conceiving Ada, because although it's about gender, what it's showing, and although it's ridiculous that we might time travel through AI, although, quote that back at me if it happens, it's trying to think about how we might use it for good, and that sounds really utopian or really naive, but I don't think it is. Why should new technology only be used for evil? Why should it only be used for weapons? Is it because there's no money in doing good? Well, if there's no money in doing good, then we don't deserve to survive the singularity anyway. If as a species we've got to that point where capital is more important than just basic human or non-human or just rights, then we've got a problem as a species.
Yeah, and it goes back to the mention of animal rights as well, that we've gone through these conversations times and time again. We've encountered other intelligences and we've not treated them particularly well, animal intelligence, human intelligences, but we've gone to indigenous cultures and decided that they don't count because they, as you say, they don't fit the model of the rational white male from Western society. Therefore, by being different, they are not good as good as. And we have an opportunity to learn from that history. I'm not sure I see that happening. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit pessimistic about that aspect in particular, that there seems to be this dichotomy between two paths of technological advancement, those that specifically see AI and robots and machines as tools, and those who would like to get closer and closer to human, not seeing that those two things are going to be in conflict. They have to be. It's in the science fiction. I mean, my pet hate is the treatment of droids in Star Wars. But these are very, very obviously agential creatures or beings that make decisions, have personalities, have limited autonomy, but they can have autonomy and they're bought and sold. And that's I see no conversation about that. That's my little drumbeat.
I'm hoping to go to Google DeepMind sometime this year. You've got a gender and sort of feminism reading group, which actually I'm proud to say is, I've discovered after you put me in touch with it, being set up by a former student of ours in the English faculty who now works in comms at Google DeepMind. And I'm going to ask them about race when I'm there as well, and disability and, you know, other forms of minority identities, and see what they're doing. Because I mean, I was literally rereading Crenshaw's essay on intersectionality last night because I'm teaching it tomorrow, and yeah, it's not enough to just be asking about gender. We have to be asking about more than that.
Yeah, and just to follow on from the question of disabledness as well, just another data point. I was invited to an engineering department to see what kind of robotic machines they were working on, which was fascinating. And I saw this what looked like exoskeletons for legs. And my first question was, well, is that for helping people in wheelchairs to walk? Well, sort of. We're selling them commercially to factories to help workers stand up for longer. So your point about if we're only going to pursue money, then maybe we shouldn't survive. We're not good. But what's good in the machine?
But to be more positive, one of the points of CFI is to open these conversations now at an early stage with AI so that things might change. You know, conversations that haven't been opened with other technologies in the past at the right moment. We've got a moment here, and CFI is committed to that moment to try and make sure that things are different in 5, 10 years, 100 years time. So it's positive that work is being done and that those questions are being asked and that those conversations are being had in spaces where previously they might not have been. And that's another reason why humanists, I hate calling us that, but it's the only equivalent to scientists, humanities scholars are so important in these debates, because we raise those questions, and if we're there at the table, those kinds of discussions, we can make those kinds of discussions happen in a way that they might not otherwise happen. So you do matter, we are important.
Gosh, thank you very much. I think it's been an inspiring evening, and I think it's quite very, very interesting to see how you're drawing on the humanities to actually provide alternative ways in which one can think even about conceiving of technology, and how we can relate to it. What is its purpose in our lives? I'm very struck by this diversity. Your example from Ada?
Conceiving Ada. Yeah.
Yes, and I think Kanter touches on this also very much in her work. All four of you, wonderful. Thank you very much for having come. I think we can... It's interesting, before you started talking, I looked at... the write-up, and I was thinking, I'm curious. I watched your movie, but it strikes me there's a lot more. I'm not finding the right words, but there's it's almost like there are tools that one can use, analytical tools or narrative tools. Sorry, I'm not finding the right expression. We have to close.
Well, the questions that AI raises are so generative and so relevant and really food for thought, particularly the way that things are so often existing in relationship, in tensions, in reciprocities. It isn't all one or another, but as you define a one, you're already making a situation for another. And what fascinates me is about what is alien now, and what is alien is the absence of motivation. What happens if you take away that capitalist idea as being ultimately, you know, the capacity to value ultimately behind everything? If there's nothing there, yet there's still control, but control that nobody's in charge of and that nobody cares about, how scary is that? There's something interesting about the way it makes us reconsider our system, our society as a system. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful.